Recorded books and one-click digital present Wireless, stories by Charles Stross. Narrated by Tim Gerard Reynolds, Gideon Emery, Paul Hecht, and Robert Ian McKenzie. This collection begins with the following introduction by the author. Hello, and welcome to Wireless. This isn't a novel. This is a short story collection. This isn't a short story. This is the introduction to a short story collection. This isn't fiction. This is a sequence of concepts that I am transferring into your conscious awareness via the medium of words, some of which may be false. Danger. Here be epistemological dragons. I'm Charlie Stross, and I have a vice I indulge in from time to time. I write short fiction. I've been writing short stories in various length factors and getting them published in magazines for a long time. My first short story in the British science fiction magazine Interzone came out in 1986, and although I don't make much money at it, I still keep doing it, even though these days I write full-time for my living. Short stories are a famously dead format in most genre of written fiction. Back in the 1950s, there was a plethora of fiction magazines on the shelves of every newsagent. But changes in the structure of the magazine publishing business killed the fiction markets, and what had once been a major source of income for many writers turned into a desert. Even science fiction, which has a long tradition of short stories as a major subfield, going back to the 1920s and the pages of astounding science fiction, and which has fared better than any other genre in terms of the survival of the monthly magazines, isn't a terribly fertile field to plough. Because of the way the publishing industry has evolved, if you want to earn a living, you really need to write novels. Short fiction outlets, with very few exceptions, pay abysmally. It wasn't always thus. The science fiction novel was itself something of a novelty until the 1950s. The famous names of the early science fiction literary canon, Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, Arthur C. Clarke, and less well-remembered names such as Frederick Brown and Cyril Cornbluth and Alfred Bester, were primarily short fiction writers. With dozens of monthly newsstand pulp fiction magazines demanding to be fed, and a public not yet weaned to the glass teat of television, the field was huge. Video didn't so much kill the radio star as it did for the short fiction markets, providing an alternative distraction on demand for tired workers to chill out with. But the science fiction short story field survives to this day. It's in much better shape, paradoxically, than other genre, where the form has all but died. It would be hard to describe it as thriving, at least compared to the golden age of pulps. But science fiction readers are traditionalists, and those of us who write short fiction aren't primarily in it for the money. We've got other, less obvious incentives. Actually, I'm not sure I know anyone who writes fiction at any length solely for money. If you've got the skill to string words into sentences, there are any number of ways to earn a living, most of which are far less precarious than the life of a freelance fiction writer. At the risk of overgeneralizing, it's one of those occupations you go into because you can't not do it. And any attempts to justify it by pointing to commercial success are, at best, special pleading. If Stephen King had failed to get his big break with Carrie, if J.K. Rowling's first Harry Potter book has sold out its first 1,000-copy print run and thereafter gone out of print, I'm willing to bet that they'd have kept on writing regardless. Speaking for myself, I'm an obsessive fiction writer. I write because I've got a cloud of really neat ideas buzzing around my brain, and I need to let them out, lest my head explode. But having ideas is only part of the reason I write. Otherwise, I could just keep a private journal. The other monkey riding my back is the urge to communicate, to reach out and touch someone, or to lift the lid on their brain pan, sprinkle some cognitive dissonance inside, stir briskly, then tiptoe away with a deranged titter. Everyone I know who does this job has got the same monkey on their shoulders, urging them on, inciting them to publish or be damned, communicate or die. If you're a compulsive communicator, nothing gets your attention like feedback from the public. A signal saying, message received. To many writers, money is one kind of feedback. Nothing says message received quite like the first royalty check after your book earns out the advance. It tells you that people actually went out and bought it, and it pays the grocery bills. Then there are the reviews, be they brilliant or misguided, or occasionally brilliant and misguided, which tell you a little bit about how the message was received or misunderstood. They don't pay the grocery bills, but they still matter to us. But the feedback from a novel is slow to arrive, and thin beer indeed after the amount of effort that went into fermenting the brew. Imagine you've got an office job. You go to work every day, and there's a perk. The office is about 10 feet from your bedroom door. No lengthy commute. You sit in that office, alone for the most part, and write, hopefully without interruption or human companionship. Sometimes you get bored and take a day or two off, or go do the housework, or go shopping. And sometimes you find yourself working there at 10 p.m. on a Saturday night because you took Friday off, and Thursday before it, and your demon conscience is whispering in your ear, reminding you to put in the hours. You're almost always on your own. You'll find it generally takes somewhere between a month and a year to write a novel. Sometimes more, sometimes less. And once it's written, you deliver it to your agent or editor, and it disappears for a couple of months. Then it reappears as a job in the publisher's production queue, moving in lockstep through a series of well-defined processes on its way to being turned into cartons of finished books. There's a little wiggle room, but in general, if you turn in a book, it will take a year to show up in hardcover, and then another year before it's reprinted in paperback. So, once a year, you get the fanfare and fireworks show of a new book coming into print, and then the reviews and reader comments trickle in, usually over a period of a couple of months. Then the long silence resumes, punctuated by the odd piece of fan mail, a surprising proportion of which is concerned with pointing out the same hugely significant typo on page 7 that escaped both you and your editors as the previous 16 emails. Short stories are different. They push the reward feedback button much more frequently than novels. And that's why a lot of us start out writing short stories before we tackle novels. There's an addictive quality to writing short stories, like being a rat in a behavioural science experiment that rewards correct performance of some complex task with a little electric shock to the medial forebrain bundle. Not only do they not take months or years to write, when things are going well, it's more like hours or days, but you can send them out to a magazine or anthology editor with some hope of hearing back within a couple of months. Better still, if a magazine decides to buy your story, it can be in print in a couple of months. Push the button harder, rat! Is great training for acquiring the motivation to engage with the bigger, slower job of writing a novel. The speed of the short story publication cycle brings me to the second reason I write them. I get to play with new ideas in a way I can't manage at novel length. Novels are huge, cumbersome projects that take a long time to bolt together. In contrast, short stories are a quick vehicle for trying out something new, the fiction writer's experimental workbench. I can focus on a particular idea or technique to the exclusion of everything else. which brings it into focus and lets me explore it to the full without worrying about whether it unbalances the plot development or fits with the protagonist's motivations or whatever. The lack of money also means there's less at stake. If I'm working on a novel, I can't afford to try out an untested new writing technique in it. At worst, I might end up having to throw 6 months writing in the trash when it proves unfixable. A mess in any situation, and potentially catastrophic if you're self-employed and working to a deadline. But I can take a day or two off to write a short story and see if it works. Throw it at a magazine, put it out in public, and see if my readers throw rotten tomatoes or gold sovereigns. Or, for a bigger idea, a new stylistic experiment, for example, I can treat it as a pilot project for a novel. Take a month, write a couple of novelettes or a novella, find a home for them in an anthology or a magazine. Anyway, here's Wireless. I wrote the stories in this collection between 1998 and 2008. Some of them were purportedly written for money. At least an editor approached me and said, "Would you like to write me a story about subject X? I'll pay." But none of them was cost-effective. The money was just the excuse. They span the spectrum from the short Maxos all the way up to Palimpsest and Missile Gap. Novellas that bump up close to the complexity and depth associated with novels. Some of them were written in response to a specific challenge from an editor. Unwirer, for example, had to fit a theme anthology's remit. Tales in which the developmental history of science and technology had followed a different path. While some were written in response to challenges from within. Snowball's Chance, because an imp of the perverse taunted me to write a traditional Pact with the Devil story. Some were stylistic experiments. Trunk and Disorderly might, had things gone differently, become the opening of a novel. Instead, I settled for the easier technique of Saturn's Children, while others were exercises in a familiar key. Down on the Farm, for example, is one of a piece with my other laundry stories collected in the Atrocity Archives and the Jennifer Morgue. What they've all got in common, however, is that they're a communication channel. Hello? Are you receiving? Over. And now, the first story in this collection, Missile Gap, narrated by Tim Gerard Reynolds.
Bomb Scare. Gregor is feeding pigeons down in the park when the sirens go off. A stoop-shouldered 40-something male in a dark suit, pale-skinned and thin, he pays no attention at first. The birds hold his attention. He stands at the side of a tarmac path, surrounded by damp grass that appears to have been sprayed with concrete dust, and digs into the outer pocket of his raincoat for a final handful of stale breadcrumbs. Filthy, soot-blackened city pigeons with malformed feet jostle with plump, white-collared wood pigeons, pecking and lunging for morsels. Gregor doesn't smile. What, to him, is a handful of stale bread is a deadly business for the birds, a matter of survival. The avian struggle for survival runs parallel to the human condition, he thinks. It's all a matter of limited resources and critical positioning, of intervention by agencies beyond their bird-brained understanding, dropping treats for them to fight over. Then the air raid sirens start up. The pigeons scatter for the treetops with a clatter of wings. Gregor straightens and looks round. It's not just one siren, and not just a test. A policeman is pedaling his bicycle along the path toward him, waving one-handed.
You there! Take cover!
Gregor turns and presents his identity card.
Where is the nearest shelter?
The constable points toward a public convenience 30 yards away.
The basement there. If you can't make it inside, you'll have to take cover behind the east wall. If you're caught in the open, just duck and cover in the nearest low spot. Now, go!
The cop hops back on his black bone shaker and is off down the footpath before Gregor can frame a reply. Shaking his head, he walks toward the public toilet and goes inside. It's early spring, a weekday morning, and the toilet attendant seems to be taking the emergency as a personal comment on the cleanliness of his porcelain. He jumps up and down agitatedly as he shows Gregor down the spiral staircase into the shelter, like a short troll in a blue uniform stocking his larder.
3 minutes, shouts the troll. Hold fast in 3 minutes.
So many people in London are wearing uniforms these days, Gregor reflects. It's almost as if they believe that if they play their wartime role properly, the ineffable will constrain itself to their expectations of a humanly comprehensible enemy. A double bang splits the air above the park and echoes down the stairwell. It'll be RAF or USAF interceptors outbound from the big fighter base near Hanworth. Gregor glances round. A couple of oafish gardeners sit on the wooden benches inside the concrete tunnel of the shelter, and a louche city type in a suit leans against the wall, irritably fiddling with an unlit cigarette and glaring at the no-smoking signs.
Bloody nuisance, eh?
He snarls in Gregor's direction. Gregor composes his face in a thin smile.
I couldn't possibly comment,
he says, his Hungarian accent betraying his status as a refugee. Another sonic boom rattles the urinals, signalling the passage of yet more fighters. The louche businessman will be his contact, Goldsmith. He glances at the shelter's counter. Its dial is twirling slowly, signalling the marked absence of radon and fallout. Time to make small talk. Verbal primate grooming.
Does it happen often?
The corporate tough relaxes. He chuckles to himself. He'll have pegged Gregor as a visitor from stranger shores, the new NATO dominions overseas where they settled the latest wave of refugees ejected by the communists. Taking in the copy of the Telegraph and the patterned stripes on Gregor's tie, he'll have realized what else Gregor is to him.
You should know. You took your time getting down here. Do you come here often to visit the front line, eh?
I am here in this bunker with you.
Gregor shrugs.
There is no front line on a circular surface.
He sits down gingerly on the bench opposite the businessman. Cigarette?
Don't mind if I do.
The businessman borrows Gregor's cigarette case with a flourish. The symbolic peace offering accepted, they sit in silence for a couple of minutes, waiting to find out if it's the curtain call for World War IV or just a trailer. A different note drifts down the staircase, the warbling tone that indicates the all clear these days. The Soviet bombers have turned for home, the ragged lion's stumpy tail tickled yet again. The toilet troll dashes down the staircase and windmills his arms at them.
No smoking in the nuclear bunker, he screams. Get out! Out, I say!
Gregor walks back into Regent's Park to finish disposing of his stale breadcrumbs and ferry the contents of his cigarette case back to the office. The businessman doesn't know it yet, but he's going to be arrested, and his English nationalist-neutralist cabal interned. Meanwhile, Gregor is being recalled to Washington, D.C. This is his last visit, at least on this particular assignment. There are thin times ahead for the wood pigeons. Voyage. It's a moonless night, and the huge reddened whirlpool of the Milky Way lies below the horizon, with only the blue-white pinprick glare of Lucifer for illumination. It's too dark to read a newspaper. Maddie is old enough to remember a time when night was something else, when darkness stalked the heavens, the Milky Way a faded tatter spun across half the sky, a time when ominous Soviet spheres bleeped and hummed their way across a horizon that curved, when geometry was dominated by pi, Astronomy made sense, and serious men with horn-rimmed glasses and German accents were going to the moon. October 2nd, 1962. That's when it all changed. That's when life stopped making sense. Of course, it first stopped making sense a few days earlier, with the U-2 flights over the concrete emplacements in Cuba. But there was a difference between the lunacy of brinksmanship, Khrushchev's shoe banging on the table at the UN as he shouted, "We will bury you!" and the flat earth daydream that followed, shattering history and plunging them all into this nightmare of revisionist geography. But back to the here and now. She's sitting on the deck of an elderly ocean liner on her way from somewhere to nowhere. And she's annoyed because Bob is getting drunk with the F-deck boys again and eating into their precious grubstake. It's too dark to read the ship's daily news sheet. Mimeographed blurry headlines from a world already fading into the ship's wake. It'll be at least 2 weeks before their next landfall. A refueling depot, somewhere in what the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration surveyors, in a fit of uncharacteristic wit, named the Nether Ocean. And she's half out of her skull with boredom. When they signed up for emigration board tickets, Bob had joked, "A 6-month cruise? After a vacation like that, we'll be happy to get back to work." But somehow, the sheer immensity of it all didn't sink in until the 4th week out of sight of land. In those 4 weeks, they'd crawled an expansive ocean wider than the Pacific, pausing to refuel twice from huge rust-coloured barges, and still they were only a 1/6 of the way to continent F-204, New Iowa, immersed like the ultimate non sequitur in the ocean that replaced the world's horizons on October 2nd. 1962. 2 weeks later, they passed the radiators. The radiators thrust from the oceanic depths to the stratosphere, Everest-high black fins finger-combing the watery currents. Beyond them, the tropical heat of the Pacific gave way to the sub-Arctic chill of the Nether Ocean. Sailing between them, the ship was reduced to the proportions of a cockroach crawling along a canyon between skyscrapers. Maddie had taken one look at these guardians of interplanetary ocean, shuddered, and retreated into their cramped room for the 2 days it took to sail out from between the slabs. Bob kept going on about how materials scientists from NOAA and the National Institutes were still trying to understand what they were made of, until Maddie snapped at him. He didn't seem to understand that they were the bars on a prison cell. He seemed to see a waterway as wide as the English Channel, and a gateway to the future. But Maddie saw them as a sign that her old life was over. If only Bob and her father hadn't argued, or if Mum hadn't tried to pick a fight with her over Bob. Maddie leans on the railings and sighs, and a moment later nearly jumps out of her skin as a strange man clears his throat behind her. "Excuse me, I didn't mean to disturb you." "That's all right," Maddie replies, irritated and trying to conceal it. "I was just going in." "A shame. It's a beautiful night," says the stranger. He turns and puts down a large briefcase next to the railing, fiddling with the latches. "Not a cloud in sight. Just right for stargazing." She focuses on him, seeing short hair, a small paunch, and a worried 30-something face. He doesn't look back, being preoccupied with something that resembles a photographer's tripod. "Is that a telescope?" she asks, eyeing the stubby cylindrical gadget in his case.
"Yes."
An awkward pause.
"Name's John Martin. Yourself?"
"Maddie Holbright." Something about his diffident manner puts her at ease. "Are you settling? I haven't seen you around." He straightens up and tightens joints on the tripod's legs, screwing them into place.
"I'm not a settler. I'm a researcher."
5 years, all expenses paid, to go and explore a new continent.
He carefully lifts the telescope body up and lowers it onto the platform, then begins tightening screws.
And I'm supposed to point this thing at the sky and make regular observations. I'm actually an entomologist, but there are so many things to do that they want me to be a jack-of-all-trades, I guess.
So they've got you to carry a telescope, huh? I don't think I've ever met an entomologist before.
A bug hunter with a telescope, he agrees. Kind of unexpected.
Intrigued, Maddie watches as he screws the viewfinder into place, then pulls out a notebook and jots something down. What are you looking at?
He shrugs. There's a good view of Esteradus from here, he says. You know, Satan. And his two little angels.
Maddie glances up at the violent pinprick of light, then looks away before it can burn her eyes. It's a star, but bright enough to cast shadows from half a light year's distance. The discs.
Them.
There's a camera body in his bag, a chunky old Bronica from back before the Soviets swallowed Switzerland and Germany whole. He carefully screws it onto the telescope's viewfinder.
The Institute wants me to take a series of photographs of them. Nothing fancy, just the best this 8-inch reflector can do. Over 6 months. Plot the ship's position on a map. There's a bigger telescope in the hold for when I arrive, and they're talking about sending a real astronomer one of these days. But in the meantime, they want photographs from 60,000 miles out across the disk. For parallax, so they can work out how fast the other disks are moving.
Disks. They seem like distant abstractions to her, but John's enthusiasm is hard to ignore. Do you suppose they're like, here?
She doesn't say like Earth. Everybody knows this isn't Earth anymore. Not the way it used to be. Maybe.
He busies himself for a minute with a chunky film cartridge.
They've got oxygen in their atmospheres, we know that. And they're big enough. Well, they're most of a light year away. Far closer than the stars, but still too far for telescopes.
Or moon rockets, she says, slightly wistfully. Or Sputniks.
If those things worked anymore.
The film is in. He leans over the scope and brings it round to bear on the first of the discs, a couple of degrees off from Satan. The discs are invisible to the naked eye. It takes a telescope to see their reflected light. He glances up at her.
Do you remember the moon?
Maddie shrugs. I was just a kid when it happened, but I saw the moon some nights. During the day, too.
He nods. Not like some of the kids these days. Tell them we used to live in a big spinning sphere and they look at you like you're mad.
What do they think the speed of the discs will tell them? She asks.
Whether they're all as massive as this one. What they could be made of. What that tells us about who it was that made them. He shrugs. Don't ask me. I'm just a bug hunter. This stuff is big, bigger than bugs. He chuckles. It's a new world out here.
She nods, very seriously, then actually sees him for the first time. I guess it is.
Boldly go.
So tell me, Comrade Colonel, how did it really feel?
The Comrade Colonel laughs uneasily. He's 43 and still slim and boyish-looking, but carries a quiet melancholy around with him like his own personal storm cloud.
I was very busy all the time, he says with a self-deprecating little shrug. I didn't have time to pay attention to myself. One orbit, it only lasted 90 minutes. What did you expect? If you really want to know, German's the man to ask. He had more time.
Time.
His interrogator sighs and leans his chair back on two legs. It's a horribly old, rather precious Queen Anne original, a gift to some Tsar or other,
many years before the October Revolution.
What a joke. 90 minutes, 2 days, that's all we got before they changed the rules on us.
They, Comrade Chairman? The Colonel looked puzzled.
Whoever.
The Chairman's vague wave takes in half the horizon of the richly panelled Kremlin office.
What a joke. Whoever they were, at least they saved us from a pasting in Cuba because of that louse Nikita.
He pauses for a moment, then toys with the wine glass that sits half empty before him. The Colonel has a glass too, but his is full of grape juice, out of consideration for his past difficulties.
The whoever I speak of are, of course, the brother socialists from the stars who brought us here.
He grins humorlessly, face creasing like the muzzle of a shark that smells blood in the water.
Brother socialists?
The Colonel smiles hesitantly, wondering if it's a joke, and if so, whether he's allowed to share it. He's still unsure why he's being interviewed by the Premier, in his private office at that.
Do we know anything of them, sir? That is, am I supposed to... Never mind.
Alexei sniffs, dismissing the Colonel's worries.
Yes, you're clear to know everything on this topic. The trouble is, there is nothing to know. And this troubles me, Yuri Alexeyevich. We infer purpose, the engine of a greater history at work, but the dialectic is silent on this matter. I have consulted the experts, asked them to read the chicken entrails, but none of them can do anything other than parrot pre-event dogma. Any species advanced enough to do to us what happened that day must, of course, have evolved true communism, Comrade Premier. Look what they did for us.
That was Shlavsky, by the way.
And yes, I look and I see 6 cities that nobody can live in, spaceships that refuse to stick to the sky, and a landscape that Zakharov and that bunch of double domes are at a loss to explain. There are fucking miracles and wonders and portents in the sky, like a galaxy we were supposed to be part of, that is now 1,000,000 years too old and shows extensive signs of construction. There's no room for miracles and wonders in our rational world, and it's giving the Comrade General Secretary, Yuri, the Comrade General Secretary, stomach ulcers. Did you know that?
The Colonel sits up straight, anticipating the punchline. It's a well-known fact throughout the USSR that when Brezhnev says frog, the Premier croaks. And here he is, in the Premier's office, watching that very man, Alexei Kosygin, chairman of the Council of Ministers, third most powerful man in the Soviet Union, taking a deep breath.
Yuri Alexeyevich, I have brought you here today because I want you to help set Leonid Ilyich's stomach at rest. You're an aviator and a hero of the Soviet Union, and, more importantly, you're smart enough to do the job and young enough to see it through. Not like the old farts cluttering up Stavka. It's going to take most of a lifetime to sort out, you mark my words. You're also, you will pardon the bluntness, about as much use as a fifth wheel in your current posting right now. We have to face facts, and the sad reality is that none of Korolev's birds will ever fly again. Not even with the atomic bomb pusher thing they've been working on.
Kosygin sighs and shuffles upright in his chair.
There is simply no point in maintaining the Cosmonaut Training Center. A decree has been drafted and will be approved next week. The manned rocket program is going to be wound up and the Cosmonaut Corps reassigned to other duties.
The Colonel flinches.
Is that absolutely necessary, Comrade Chairman?
Kosygin drains his wine glass, decides to ignore the implied criticism.
We don't have the resources to waste. But, Yuri Alexeyevich, all that training is not lost.
He grins, wolfishly.
I have new worlds for you to explore, and a new ship for you to do it in.
A new ship? The Colonel nods, then does a double take, punch drunk.
A ship?
Well, it isn't a fucking horse, says Kosygin.
He slides a big glossy photograph across his blotter toward the colonel.
Times have moved on.
The colonel blinks in confusion as he tries to make sense of the thing at the center of the photograph. The premier watches his face, secretly amused. Confusion is everybody's first reaction to the thing in the photograph.
I am not sure I understand, sir.
It's quite simple. You train to explore new worlds. You can't, not using the rockets. The rockets won't ever make orbit. I've had astronomers having nervous breakdowns trying to explain why, but they all agree on the key point. Rockets won't do it for us here. Something wrong with the gravity, they say it even crushes falling starlight.
The chairman taps a fat finger on the photograph.
But you can do it using this. We invented it, and the bloody Americans didn't. It's called an ekranoplan, and you rocket boys are going to stop being grounded cosmonauts and learn how to fly it. What do you think, Colonel Gagarin?
The colonel whistles tunelessly through his teeth. He's finally worked out the scale. It looks like a flying boat with clipped wings, jet engines clustered by the sides of its cockpit. But no flying boat ever carried a runway with a brace of MiG-21s on its back.
It's bigger than a cruiser. Is it nuclear-powered?
Of course!
The chairman's grin slips.
It cost as much as those moon rockets of Sergei's, Colonel General. Try not to drop it.
Gagarin glances up, surprise and awe visible on his face.
Sir, I'm honored, but...
Don't be. The chairman cuts him off. The promotion was coming your way anyway. The posting that comes with it will earn you as much honor as that first orbit. A second chance at space, if you like. But you can't fail. The cost is unthinkable. It's not your skin that will pay the toll. It's our entire rationalist civilization.
Kosygin leans forward intently.
Somewhere out there are beings so advanced that they skinned the earth like a grape and plated it onto this disk. Or worse, copied us right down to the atomic level and duplicated us like one of those American Xerox machines. It's not just us, though. You are aware of the other continents and the oceans. We think some of them may be inhabited, too. Nothing else makes sense. Your task is to take the Sergei Korolev, the first ship of its class, on a historic 5-year cruise. You will boldly go where no Soviet man has gone before, explore new worlds, and look for new peoples, and establish fraternal socialist relations with them. But your primary objective is to discover who built this giant mousetrap of a world, and why they brought us to it, and to report back to us, before the Americans find out.
Committee process. The cherry trees are in bloom in Washington, D.C., and Gregor perspires in the summer heat. He has grown used to the relative cool of London, and this unaccustomed change of climate has disoriented him. Jet lag is a thing of the past, a small mercy, but there are still adjustments to make. Because the disk is flat, the daylight source, polar flares from an accretion disk inside the axial hole, the scientists call it, which signifies nothing to most people, grows and shrinks the same wherever you stand. There's a concrete 60s vintage office block with a conference suite furnished in burnt umber and orange, chromed chairs and Kandinsky prints on the walls. All very 70s. Gregor waits outside the suite until the buzzer sounds and the receptionist looks up from behind her IBM typewriter and says, "You can go in now. They're expecting you." Gregor goes in. It's an occupational hazard, but by no means the worst in his line of work.
"Have a seat."
It's Seth Brundle, Gregor's divisional head, a grey-looking functionary, more adept at office backstabbing than field-expedient assassinations.
His cover, like Gregor's, is an innocuous-sounding post in the Office of Technology Assessment. In fact, both he and Gregor work for a different government agency, although the notional task is the same. Identify technological threats and stamp on them before they emerge. Brundel is not alone in the room. He proceeds with the introductions.
Greg Samsa, our London station chief and specialist in scientific intelligence. Greg, this is Marcus.
The bald, thin-faced German in the smart suit bobs his head and smiles behind his horn-rimmed glasses.
Civilian consultant.
Gregor mistrusts him on sight. Marcus is a defector, a former Stasi spook from back before the Brezhnev purges of the mid-60s, which puts an interesting complexion on this meeting.
Murray Fox, from Langley.
Hi, says Gregor, wondering just what kind of insane political critical mass Stone is trying to assemble. Langley and Brundle's parent outfit aren't even on speaking terms, to say the least.
And another civilian specialist, Dr. Sagan.
Greg nods at the doctor, a thin guy with sparkling brown eyes and hippie-ish long hair.
Greg's got something to tell us in person, says Brundel. Something very interesting he picked up in London. No sources, please, Greg.
No sources,
Gregor echoes. He pulls out a chair and sits down. Now that he's here, he supposes he'll just have to play the role Brundel assigned to him in the confidential briefing he read on the long flight home.
We have word from an unimpeachable human resource that the Russians have...
He coughs into his fist.
Excuse me.
He glances at Brundel.
Okay to talk about Collection Ruby? They're all cleared, Brundel says dryly. That's why it says Joint Committee on the letterhead.
I see. My invitation was somewhat terse.
Gregor stifles a sigh that seems to say, all I get is a most urgent recall. How am I meant to know what's going on and who knows what?
So why are we here?
Think of it as another collective analysis board, says Fox, the man from the CIA.
He doesn't look enthused.
We're here to find out what's going on, with the benefit of some intelligence resources from the other side of the curtain.
Dr. Sagan, who has been listening silently with his head cocked to one side like a very intelligent blackbird, raises an eyebrow.
Yes, says Brundel.
Would you mind explaining that to me? I haven't been on one of these committees before.
No, indeed, thinks Gregor. It's a miracle Sagan ever passed his political vetting. He's too friendly by far with some of those Russian astronomer guys who are clearly under the thumb of the KGB's first department. And he's expressed doubts, muted, of course, about the thrust of current foreign policy, which is a serious no-no under the McNamara administration.
A CAB is a joint committee feeding into the Central Office of Information's external bureaus on behalf of a blue-ribbon panel of experts assembled from the intelligence community.
Gregor recites in a bored tone of voice.
Stripped of the bullshit, we're a board of wise men who are meant to rise above narrow bureaucratic lines of engagement and prepare a report for the Office of Technology Assessment to pass on to the Director of Central Intelligence. It's not meant to reflect the agenda of any one department, but to be a Delphi board, synergizing our lateralities. Set up after the Cuban fiasco to make sure that we never again get backed into that kind of corner by accidental groupthink. One of the rules of the CAB process is that it has to include at least one dissident. Unlike the commies, we know we're not perfect.
Gregor glances pointedly at Fox, who has the good sense to stay silent.
Oh, I see,
Sagan says hesitantly,
with more force. So that's why I'm here. Is that the only reason you've dragged me away from Cornell?
Of course not, Doctor,
oozes Brundle, casting Gregor a dirty look. The East German defector, Wolf, maintains a smug silence.
I am above all this.
We are here to come up with policy recommendations for dealing with the bigger picture. The much bigger picture. The builders, says Fox. We're here to determine what our options look like if and when they show up, and to make recommendations about the appropriate course of action. Your background in, SETI recommended you.
Sagan looks at him in disbelief. I'd have thought that was obvious, he says.
Huh?
We won't have any choice. The young professor explains with a wry smile.
Does the termite mound negotiate with a nuclear superpower?
Brundle leans forward. That's a rather radical position, isn't it? Surely there'll be some room for maneuver. We know this is an artificial construct, but presumably the builders are still living people, even if they've got green skin and six eyes.
Oh my God.
Sagan leans forward, his face in his hands. After a moment, Gregor realizes that he's laughing.
Excuse me?
Gregor glances round.
It's the German defector, Wolf, or whatever he's called. Professor, would you care to explain what you find so funny?
After a moment, Sagan leans back, looks at the ceiling, and sighs.
Imagine a single, a 45 RPM record with a center hole punched out. The inner hole is half an astronomical unit, 46 million miles in radius. The outer edge is of unknown radius, but probably about 2.5 AUs, 245 million miles. The disk's thickness is unknown. Seismic waves are reflected off a mirror-like rigid layer 800 miles down, but we can estimate it at 8,000 miles. If its density averages out at the same as Earth's. Surface gravity is the same as our original planet, and since we've been transplanted here and survived, we have learned that it's a remarkably hospitable environment for our kind of life. Only on the large scale does it seem different.
The astronomer sits up.
Do any of you gentlemen have any idea just how preposterously powerful whoever built this structure is?
How do you mean preposterously powerful? Asks Brundle, looking more interested than annoyed.
A colleague of mine, Dan Alderson, did the first analysis. I think you might have done better to pull him in, frankly. Anyway, let me itemize. Item number one is escape velocity.
Sagan holds up a bony finger.
Gravity on a disk does not diminish in accordance with the inverse square law, the way it does on a spherical object like the planet we came from. We have roughly Earth-like gravity, but to escape, or to reach orbit, takes tremendously more speed. Roughly 200 times more, in fact. Rockets that from Earth could reach the moon just fall out of the sky after running out of fuel. Next item.
Another finger.
The area and mass of the disk. If it's double-sided, it has a surface equal to billions and billions of Earths. We're stuck in the middle of an ocean full of alien continents, but we have no guarantee that this hospitable environment is anything other than a tiny oasis in a world of strangeness.
The astronomer pauses to pour himself a glass of water, then glances round the table.
To put it in perspective, gentlemen, this world is so big that, if one in every 100 stars had an Earth-like planet, this single structure could support the population of our entire home galaxy. As for the mass, this structure is as massive as 50,000 suns. It is, quite bluntly, impossible. As yet unknown physical forces must be at work to keep it from rapidly collapsing in on itself and creating a black hole. The repulsive force, whatever it is strong enough to hold the weight of 50,000 suns. Think about that for a moment, gentlemen.
At that point, Sagan looks around and notices the blank stares. He chuckles ruefully.
What I mean to say is, the structure is not permitted by the laws of physics as we understand them. Because it clearly does exist, we can draw some conclusions, starting with the fact that our understanding of physics is incomplete. Well, that isn't news. We know we don't have a unified theory of everything. Einstein spent 30 years looking for one and didn't come up with it. But secondly,
he looks tired for a moment, aged beyond his years.
We used to think that any extraterrestrial beings we might communicate with would be fundamentally comprehensible. Folks like us, albeit with better technology. I think that's the frame of mind you're still working in. Back in 61, we had a brainstorming session at a conference trying to work out just how big an engineering project a spacefaring civilization might come up with. Freeman Dyson from Princeton came up with about the biggest thing any of us could imagine. Something that required us to imagine dismantling Jupiter and turning it into habitable real estate. This disk is about 100 million times bigger than Dyson's sphere, and that's before we take into account the time factor.
Time? Echoes Fox from Langley, sounding confused.
Time.
Sagan smiles in a vaguely disconnected way.
We're nowhere near our original galactic neighborhood, and whoever moved us here, they didn't bend the laws of physics far enough to violate the speed limit. It takes light about 160,000 years to cross the distance between where we used to live and our new stellar neighborhood, the Lesser Magellanic Cloud.
Which we have fixed, incidentally, by measuring the distance to known Cepheid variables, once we were able to take into account the measurable blue shift of infalling light and the fact that some of them were changing frequency slowly and seemed to have changed rather a lot.
Our best estimate is 800,000 years, plus or minus 200,000. That's about four times as long as our species has existed, gentlemen. We're fossils. An archaeological experiment or something. Our relevance to our abductors is not as equals, but as subjects in some kind of vast experiment. And what the purpose of the experiment is, I can't tell you. I've got some guesses, but...
Sagan shrugs, then lapses into silence. Gregor catches Brundle's eye, and Brundle shakes his head very slightly.
Don't spill the beans.
Gregor nods. Sagan may realize he's in a room with a CIA spook and an East German defector, but he doesn't need to know about the alienation service yet.
Well, that's as may be, says Fox, dropping words like stones into the hollow silence at the table. But it begs the question, what are we going to tell the DCI?
I suggest, says Gregor, that we start by reviewing Collection Ruby.
He nods at Sagan.
Then, maybe when we're all up to speed on that, we'll have a better idea of whether there's anything useful we can tell the DCI.
Cannon fodder. Madeline and Robert Holbright are among the last of the immigrants to disembark on the New World. As she glances back at the brilliant white side of the liner, the horizon seems to roll around her head, settling into a strange new stasis that feels unnatural after almost 6 months at sea. New Iowa isn't flat and isn't new. Rampart cliffs loom to either side of the unnaturally deep harbor, gouged out of bedrock courtesy of General Atomics. A cog-driven funicular railway hauls Maddie and Robert and their four shipping trunks up the 1,000-foot climb to the plateau and the port city of Fort Eisenhower, and then to the arrival and orientation camp. Maddie is quiet and withdrawn,
But Bob, oblivious, natters constantly about opportunities and jobs and grabbing a plot of land to build a house on. "It's the new world," he says at one point. "Why aren't you excited?"
"The new world," Maddie echoes, biting back the urge to say something cutting.
She looks out the window as the train climbs the cliff face and brings them into sight of the city. City is the wrong word. It implies solidity, permanence. Fort Eisenhower is less than 5 years old, a leukemic gash inflicted on the landscape by the Corps of Engineers. The tallest building is the governor's mansion at 3 stories. Architecturally, the tone is Wild West meets the radar age, raw pine houses contrasting with big grey concrete boxes full of seaward-pointing Patriot missiles to deter the inevitable encroachment of the communist hordes.
It's so flat.
The nearest hills are 200 miles away, past the coastal plain. Didn't you read the map?
She ignores his little dig as the train squeals and clanks up the side of the cliff. It wheezes asthmatically to a stop beside a wooden platform and expires in a belch of saturated steam. An hour later, they're weary and sweated up in the lobby of an unprepossessing barrack hall made of raw plywood. There's a large hall and a row of tables and a bunch of bored-looking colonial service types, and people are walking from one position to another with bundles of paper, answering questions in low voices and receiving official stamps. The would-be colonists mill around like disturbed livestock among the piles of luggage at the back of the room. Maddie and Robert queue uneasily in the damp afternoon heat, overhearing snippets of conversation.
"Country of origin. Educational qualifications? Yes, but what was your last job?"
Religion and race, almost a quarter of the people in the hall are refugees from India or Pakistan or somewhere lost to the mysterious East forever, seem to obsess the officials.
"Robert," she whispers.
"It'll be all right," he says with false certainty.
Taking after his dad already, trying to pretend he's the solid family man. A sidelong glance at him steals any residual confidence.
Then it's their turn.
"Names, passports, country of origin?"
The guy with the mustache is brusque and bored, irritated by the heat. Robert smiles at him.
"Roberts and Madeline Holbright from Canada?"
He offers their passports.
"Uh-huh."
The official gives the documents a very American going over.
"What schooling have you done? What was your last job?"
I was working part-time in a garage on my way through college. I was final year at Toronto, studying structural engineering, but I haven't sat the finals. Maddie's a qualified paramedic."
The officer fixes her with a stare.
"Worked at it?"
"What? No. I'm freshly qualified."
His abrupt questioning flusters her.
"Huh."
He makes a cryptic notation against their names on a long list, a list that spills over the edge of the desk and trails toward the rough floor.
"Next!"
He hands the passports back and a couple of cards and points them along to the row of desks. Someone is already stepping up behind them when Maddie manages to read the tickets. Hers says, "Trainee nurse." Robert is staring at his and saying,
"No. This is wrong."
"What is it, Bob?"
She looks over his shoulder as someone jostles him sideways. His card reads, "Laborer. Unskilled." But she doesn't have time to read the rest.
Captain's Log. Yuri Gagarin kicks his shoes off, loosens his tie, and leans back in his chair.
"It's hotter than fucking Cuba," he complains.
"You visited Cuba, didn't you, boss?"
His companion, still standing, pours a glass of iced tea and passes it to the young Colonel General before drawing one for himself.
"Yeah, thanks, Misha."
The former first cosmonaut smiles tiredly.
Back before the invasion. Have a seat.
Misha Garadin is the only man on the ship who doesn't have to give a shit whether the captain offers him a seat, but he's grateful all the same. A little respect goes a long way, and Gagarin's sunny disposition and friendly attitude are a far cry from some of the fuckheads Misha's been stuck with in the past. There's a class of officer who thinks that because you're a Zampalit, you're somehow below them. But Yuri doesn't do that. In some ways, he's the ideal new Soviet man. Progress personified. Which makes life a lot easier, because Yuri is one of the very few naval commanders who doesn't have to give a shit what his political officer thinks, and life would be an awful lot stickier without that grease of respect to make the wheels go round. Mind you, Yuri is also the commander of the only naval warship operated by the Cosmonaut Corps, which is a branch of the Strategic Rocket Forces, another howling exception to the usual military protocol. Somehow, this posting seems to be breaking all the rules.
What was it like, boss?
Hot as hell. Humid, like this. Beautiful women, with lots of dark-skinned comrades who didn't bathe often enough. All very jolly, but you couldn't help looking out to sea, over your shoulder. You know there was an American base there even then. Guantanamo. They don't have the base now, but they've got all the rubble.
For a moment, Gagarin looks morose.
Bastards.
The Americans?
Yes, shitting on a small defenseless island like that, just because they couldn't get to us anymore. You remember when they had to hand out iodine tablets to all the kids? That wasn't Leningrad or Gorky, the fallout plume. It was Havana. I don't think they wanted to admit just how bad it was.
Misha sips his tea.
We had a lucky escape.
Morale be damned. It's acceptable to admit at least that much in front of the CO, in private. Misha's seen some of the KGB reports on the US nuclear capabilities back then, and his blood runs cold.
While Nikita had been wildly bluffing about the Rodina's nuclear defences, the Americans had been hiding the true scale of their own arsenal. From themselves, as much as the rest of the world.
Yes, things were going to the devil back then, no question. If we hadn't woken up over here, who knows what would have happened. They outgunned us back then. I don't think they realized.
Gagarin's dark expression lifts. He glances out of the open porthole, the only one in the private cabin that opens, and smiles.
This isn't Cuba, though.
The headland rising above the bay tells them that much. No tropical island on Earth supported such weird vegetation. Or such ruins.
Indeed not, but what about the ruins?
Asks Misha, putting his tea glass down on the map table.
Yes. Gagarin leans forward. I was meaning to talk to you about that. Exploration is certainly in line with our orders, but we are a trifle short of trained archaeologists, aren't we? Let's see. We're 470,000 kilometers from home, 6 major climactic zones, 5 continents. It'll be a long time before we get any settlers out here, won't it?
He pauses delicately. Even if the rumors about the reform of the penal system are true.
It is certainly a dilemma,
Misha agrees amiably, deliberately ignoring the skipper's last comment.
But we can take some time over it. There's nobody out here, at least not within range of yesterday's reconnaissance flight. I'll vouch for Lieutenant Chekhov's soundness. He has a solid attitude, that one.
I don't see how we can leave without examining the ruins, but we've got limited resources, and in any case, I don't want to do anything that might get the Academy to slap our wrists. No digging for treasure until the eggheads get here.
Gagarin hums tunelessly for a moment, then slaps his hand on his thigh.
I think we'll shoot some film for the Comrade General Secretary's birthday party.
First, we'll secure a perimeter around the beach, give those damned Spetsnaz a chance to earn all the vodka they've been drinking. Then you and I, we can take Primary Science Party 2 into the nearest ruins with lights and cameras. Make a visual record, leave the double domes back in Moscow to figure out what we're looking at and whether it's worth coming back later with a bunch of archaeologists. What do you say, Misha?
I say that's entirely logical, Comrade General, says the political officer, nodding to himself.
That's so ordered, then. We'll play it safe, though. Just because we haven't seen any active settlement patterns doesn't mean there's no Aborigines lurking in the forest.
Like that last bunch of lizards? Misha frowns. Little purple bastards.
We'll make good communists out of them eventually,
Yuri insists.
A toast! To making good communists out of little purple lizard bastards with blowpipes who shoot political officers in the arse.
Gagarin grins wickedly, and Gorodin knows when he's been wound up on purpose and summons a twinkle to his eye as he raises his glass.
And to poisons that don't work on human beings.
Discography. Warning. The following briefing film is classified Collection Ruby. If you do not possess both Collection and Ruby clearances, leave the auditorium and report to the screening security officer immediately. Disclosure to unauthorized personnel is a federal offense punishable by a fine of up to $10,000 and or imprisonment for up to 20 years. You have 30 seconds to clear the auditorium and report to the screening security officer.
Voiceover. Ocean, the final frontier. For 12 years since the momentous day when we discovered that we had been removed to this planar world, we have been confronted by the immensity of an ocean that goes on as far as we can see. Confronted also by the prospect of the spread of communism to uncharted new continents, we have committed ourselves to a strategy of exploration and containment.
Film clip. An Atlas rocket on the launch pad rises slowly, flames jetting from its tail. It surges past the gantry and disappears into the sky. Cut to a camera mounted in the nose, pointing back along the flank of the rocket. The ground falls behind, blurring into blue distance. Slowly, the sky behind the rocket is turning black, but the land still occupies much of the fisheye view. The first stage engine ring tumbles away, leaving the core engine burning with a pale blue flame. Now the outline of the California coastline is recognizable. North America shrinks visibly. Eventually another, strange outline swims into view, like a cipher in an alien script. The booster burns out and falls behind, and the tumbling camera catches sunlight glinting off the upper stage Centaur rocket as its engine ignites, thrusting it higher and faster.
Voiceover. We cannot escape.
Cut to a meteor streaking across the empty blue bowl of the sky, slowly deploying parachutes.
Voiceover. In 1962... this rocket would have blasted a 2-ton payload all the way into outer space. That was when we lived on a planet that was an oblate sphere. Life on a dinner plate seems to be different. While the gravitational attraction anywhere on the surface is a constant, we can't get away from it. In fact, anything we fire straight up will come back down again. Not even a nuclear rocket can escape. According to JPL scientist Dan Alderson, escape from a Magellanic disk would require a speed of over 1,600 miles per second. That is because this disk masses many times more than a star. In fact, it has a mass 50,000 times greater than our own sun. What stops it collapsing into a sphere? Nobody knows. Physicists speculate that a fifth force that drove the early expansion of the universe, they call it quintessence, has been harnessed by the makers of the disk. But the blunt truth is, nobody knows for sure.
nor do we understand how we came here. How, in the blink of an eye, something beyond our comprehension peeled the Earth's continents and oceans like a grape and plaited them across this alien disk.
Cut to a map. The continents of Earth are laid out. Americas at one side, Europe and Asia and Africa to their east. Beyond the Indonesian island chain, Australia and New Zealand hang lonely on the edge of an abyss of ocean. The map pans right. Strange new continents swim into view, ragged-edged and huge. A few of them are larger than Asia and Africa combined. Most of them are smaller. Voiceover.
Geopolitics was changed forever by the move. While the surface topography of our continents was largely preserved, wedges of foreign material were introduced below the Mohorovicic discontinuity, below the crust, and in the deep ocean floor, to act as spacers. The distances between points separated by deep ocean were, of necessity, changed, and not in our geopolitical favor. While the tactical balance of power after the move was much as it had been before, the great circle flight paths our strategic missiles were designed for, over the polar ice cap and down into the communist empire, were distorted and stretched, placing the enemy targets outside their range. Meanwhile, although our manned bombers could still reach Moscow with in-flight refueling, the changed map would have forced them to traverse thousands of miles of hostile airspace en route. The move rendered most of our strategic preparations useless. If the British had been willing to stand firm, we might have prevailed. But in retrospect, what went for us also went for the Soviets, and it is hard to condemn the British for being unwilling to take the full force of the inevitable Soviet bombardment alone. In retrospect, the only reason this was not a complete disaster for us is that the Soviets were caught in the same disarray as ourselves. But the specter of communism now dominates Western Europe. The supposedly independent nations of the European Union are as much in the thrall to Moscow as the client states of the Warsaw Pact. Only the ongoing British state of emergency offers us any residual geopolitical traction on the Red Continent, and in the long term we must anticipate that the British, too, will be driven to reach an accommodation with the Soviet Union.